Hi, and welcome to the Japan Baseball Weekly Podcast. It's for the week of May 11th. It's early on a Saturday morning, and with me is Jim Allen. How you doing, bud?
Well, I'm okay. I'm awake. I was going to say wide awake, but I'll take awake.
Take awake, too.
How you doing, man?
I'm okay again. Had a glorious run today. This was my best run of the year for some reason. I don't even know why.
Yeah, cool.
It was the first time I was able to run outside without a jacket, because usually I have at least a windbreaker.
Yeah, it got cold today, in the last week. I mean, I noticed when we were out doing our walks. We're doing our walks now like 10 p.m. to midnight when there are fewer people out.
Are those walks or stalks?
Well, we're trying to avoid people, so I don't know which, but night stalk.
Those are the good stalking hours, man, 10 p.m. to midnight when people are coming home from a late night or something going out. Well, actually, there is not much of that going on these days.
Well, it was Golden Week especially, so I mean, a lot of people were home anyway, so it was trying.
Trying as these times are today, so we always open by saying thank you to the healthcare workers and the frontline people and emergency folks and people who are making food, people who are running the trains. We appreciate you. Thank you very much. And stay home, folks. Stay home.
Yeah, I mean, I've been reading people on my Facebook as little as I look, and I see people saying, you know, we're not going to lose out. You know, let's stop being scared. Let's get out and get back going. But I just want, and if you think that's the way to go, I'm not going to tell you what's in your best interest, but please wear a mask, not because you're afraid, but because you want to set a good example for the people around you.
Exactly. Yeah.
You know, a large percentage of the people who are dying from this are people of color. And a large number of the people are protesting. I would say virtually all the people who are protesting the restrictions are not people of color.
Correct.
And I find that somewhat disturbing. And so if you do go out, and most of the people who I know, I consider to be smart. And I just hope that you are out setting a good example for the people who are, you know, who have no symptoms and know nobody with any symptoms, because we want to keep it that you're not infecting anybody accidentally. And so be smart and be a leader.
All right. So that leads us into this week's show. And we've got an interview with former Taiyo Whales player Carlos Ponce. And we've got a couple of notes and some fantastic high heat. So let's start swinging.
So I had a chat with Carlos Ponce, and something that was long overdue. And the fun thing about this was I didn't know where he was working. I assumed he was in the United States. And So, you know, he said, let's do late at night. That's fine. And then I said, well, so what time zone are you? And he says, oh, I'm 1 hour away from you. And I went, huh? Because he lives in Florida, but he was in, somewhere in Taiwan that neither of us could pronounce, and I was unfamiliar with. It's the training base of I don't know if they're an expansion team or not. They're a team that is back in the Weichuan Dragons, and please excuse me, the CPBL people, but they're a team that used to, their company that used to sponsor a pro team in Taiwan. And they stopped. Now they're back. So
okay.
They were
back.
They're not. They're sort of a new chapter of an old team, and they are this year playing in the minor leagues, in the Taiwan's minor league.
Okay.
And they had Munenori Kawasaki was a coach for them last year in the winter leagues when they made their debut in the Taiwan Winter League, and now Carlos Ponce got a call from somebody he knew from Facebook, you know, some Facebook acquaintance, and says, how would you like to coach in Taiwan? And he's going like, what? He's 61 years old, and he's thinking like Taiwan, and that's like near China where they're having this COVID-19 outbreak, And Sonny's wife are going, no, okay, we'll give it a shot. Now, we reference it, but Carlos had for a long time been hoping to come back in Japan as a coach for the Bay Stars, his former team. And mm-hmm. He was laboring under the belief that the Bay Stars were the Giants, essentially, and that they wouldn't hire anybody who had gone anywhere else. And no other team would sign him other than the Bay Stars because he had no history with them. So anyway, we talked about his coaching and he was happy to be back in Asia and he was happy to be on the field because it was, you know, he was basically in live baseball when the rest of the world wasn't. Let's have a listen. Our guest this week on the Japan Baseball Weekly podcast, all the way from, where are you in Taiwan?
Tulio.
Okay.
I think that's how you pronounce it, Tulio.
Okay. Tulio. I'm not going to try my Mandarin today, so I'll just say from Taiwan is former Taiyo Whales star, Carlos Ponce. Thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure.
Oh, it's a pleasure, and as I said the other day, it's probably criminal that we haven't, I've never had a chance to interview you, because I've been following Japanese baseball since you arrived.
And I was, you know, it was something different for me when I got to Japan in 86.
Tell me about what was hard for you when you first arrived.
You know, I don't think I had any problem when I got there. Mm-hmm. When I made the decision to go over there, it was like starting all over, being from Puerto Rico, mm-hmm. playing the States, mm-hmm. and then go over there to Japan and play. It was, for me, was easy to adapt. Mm-hmm. I mean, of course, the language barrier.
Right.
But, you know, when I got to that, out of that plane, and I saw all these newscast people, and I said, whoa, it was something new for me.
Yeah.
I never did anything like that before. So, you know, it's like I was embraced right away, mm-hmm. even though I hadn't started playing yet. Mm. But my wife and I were just happy to be there.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you said you had a 2-year contract, you'd been in the minors, and no real future in America, and suddenly somebody, you know, how big is that for a guy who's played pro baseball for, you know, 6 years, and to have like a team, like, bend over backwards and say, you're the guy we want?
Well, I mean, first of all, I didn't expect that at that time, but when I saw that, and the way the not only the team but the fans embraced me, you know, I was just like, man, I love this. Now, my wife doesn't like that. She didn't like that because everywhere I went, hey, Mr. Ponce, all this. And I said, honey, I'm with you, okay? So, you know, she said, oh, my goodness. But just the fact that, you know, I was there didn't change nothing. Mm. I was going to go out there and play baseball.
Watching you play when you arrived, I had this feeling that, and it was just a generalization, just based on my, you know, just my thoughts, was I was thinking that a lot of the Latin guys coming to Japan would probably be a little easier to adjust to being in a different country because they were all coming. They've already done that before.
Yes. The change from one place to another was easier for to adapt. For me,
okay,
it was nothing major. It was something that I've done many times.
Okay.
So okay. I wanted to be the same guy from, you know, the past and the present and the future. So I was just the same guy.
You were just the same guy, except now you are famous.
I embrace my fans and all that. I love it, but I don't consider myself a person that, you know, just because I did what I did,
uh-huh.
I'm the same guy no mm-hmm. matter what.
Okay.
It's I think that was the reason why a lot of fans embraced me, because I was nice with everybody. Kid, you know, I remember only one time why I decided to, you know, not to sign an autograph, because I was with my wife eating in a restaurant. I said, can you please wait later? So, but other than that, no, I'm always being the same guy.
And now let's talk a little bit about the baseball.
Yeah. It's, I've been in the game for a long time,
mm-hmm.
but I never saw so many people out there. Like, like in Goshen, Argentina, Tokyo Giants, you know. Now, remember, Yokohama was a big club back then.
Mm.
We didn't get a lot of support, but only the people that were there, they supported us the whole time.
Mm.
You know, a lot of friends out there.
Okay. Now, how about the game? Was it, were there any adjustments? Now, you stayed the same, and you know, you've got the same skills. Your skills don't change because you got a different stamp in your passport. So what kind of adjustments did you have to make in order for your game to play here or to get the most out of your talent here?
Well, the first thing is mentally I was prepared just to go out there.
Okay.
I mean, there was a few rumors that when Doug Loman and myself went there that Doug was going to be the home run guy, or, you know, and I was going to be the guy who can hit the ball and, you know, run the bases. somehow, because to tell you the truth, I was never a home run hitter.
Okay.
I was a gap hitter. I hit a lot of doubles.
Okay.
Triples in the minor league system.
Mm-hmm.
One year in Double A, I hit 50 doubles.
Wow.
50, and then I leaked the league in single A with 13 doubles, a triple. And I hit a lot of triples, seven, you know, average seven.
Yeah, you hit a lot in Japan, I thought.
Yeah, for Japan, I hit a few, five, yeah. I was able to run the base as well. I was never a third baseman.
Right. I say you played your whole career base, maybe except like rookie ball, you were pretty much first baseman.
Well, that was something that Ushigami-san, you know, the Brewers, at that time we had in 85, our third baseman, Dale Swim.
Oh, yeah.
He was hurt in spring training.
Okay.
And the manager asked me, Carlos, can you play third? And I said, well, yes, of course. But I never did. Never in my life. And I guess I did okay. And then when we break to, you know, Vancouver, after a week in Vancouver, Dale got hurt again. And I started to play third base. And that's how I went from a suspect to prospect. No, it's just in the newspaper. I got my newspaper in Vancouver. Because in 1984, I struggled in AAA.
Okay.
But I knew what kind of hitter I was. I knew in my heart, I'm better than this.
Yeah, I would say your fielding at triple at third base is not going to, you know, make anybody forget. Yeah, you weren't going to forget Brooks Robinson, but... But you kept playing, man. I mean, that's the thing. Keep playing.
It didn't bother me. You know, and that's one thing that we tell the kids, you know, listen, just because you struggle as a hitter, don't try to struggle in the infield or the outfield. You know, and because I knew, okay, I'm going to do my best, but I'm not a third baseman.
Mm-hmm.
And finally, you know, Endo-san said, you're going to go the following year, you go to the outfield. I say, oh, God. So that's how I got to the outfield.
Tell me.
I was an outfield all my life.
Yeah.
Except when I got to the Brewers.
Okay.
First base. So
they put you at first base because they knew they was never going to need another first baseman. That's ironic.
No, not only that. And again, I never had a great arm.
Mm-hmm.
It was an average arm throwing, but I was a good. I was fast.
Mm-hmm.
I can feel the ball. But back in the time where I was younger, you know, back then, you know, they kept telling me, "Oh, you can hit, but you can't throw." I said, "What?" So Felix Delgado, who was a big scout there, he said, "You know what? You can be a first baseman." That's how I signed. That's a first baseman.
Huh. Well, you know, if they're gonna sign you and give you money, why not? I mean,
he said you can hit. So, but you can, and you know, so you're gonna play first base now.
Okay. Well, wow. That was Alex Ramirez. When he signed with Cleveland, he was an outfielder, and they signed him. He was a pitcher, and they signed him because they needed him to play the outfield, and the scout saw him have a good game. And he says, "What position do you play?" He says, "I'm a pitcher." He says, "Well, if you're an outfielder, I'll sign you." He says, "Okay, I'm an outfielder."
Well, yeah. I'm gonna tell you that you know, it's things are, you know. You never know.
No, you don't. Now you had a, you know, that team, and I criticize the Bay Star, the Whales a lot, because, you know, they, when you were there, that stadium was considered, you know, like a big stadium. You know, they had the inner fence at the Lucky Zone in Koshien, and Tokyo Dome was big, and Jingu was small, and Hiroshima was small, and Nagoya was small. So you guys, even now it's considered small, but then back then it was a big park, and they basically had no power hitters. They thought they were going to be like the Kansas City Royals or the Philadelphia Phillies and just run people out of games. But really, until you and Doug showed up, they didn't have anybody to hit home runs.
No, well, you know, I guess that's the reason why people embrace me, because it's like the I started the whole Chewbacca, being able to hit for home runs, power, and then they started to bring all these big hitters.
Yeah,
you know, and now you have Soto.
Sure.
Too, and then Joey Meyer.
Right,
big power from Hawaii, Joey Myers,
mm-hmm.
and then Glenn Brax.
Yeah,
and, you know, all these guys just trying to go. Bobby Rose, excellent hitter.
Yep,
you know, excellent hitter. So, you know, so because what I did, you put that platform for Yokohama to starting to, you know, do better. You know, I did a lot of things, you know, with a bad team.
Yeah.
Lead the RBIs, home runs, and that's why, that's what I did, and I'm very proud of what I did.
It was a fun team, but they were not very good. I mean, you had some good players. I remember Endo, the pitcher, amazing guy.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
And Takagi Utaka was a heck of a hitter, but it was a pretty lame team otherwise.
Yeah. So by me doing that with a team that I think the average RBI was like maybe 70, 60, and then a home run was like 15,
yeah,
or 16,
yeah,
no,
15 is on the high. Yeah, Tashiro hit a bunch, and then. But yeah, they'd been a, you know, the kind of like, we're going to be fast and that's how we're going to win, and it was a problem. So anyway, so you kind of helped change that Bay Stars team, that the Yokohama team a little, at least changed it for maybe what they could be, you know, 10 years down the road, and they're winning a championship. So okay, how much did you follow the team when you left Japan? How much did you follow Japanese baseball after you left?
All my life, I never stopped.
Okay. Now,
I never stopped.
Now, recently you got involved with the, you know, the Japan Retired Foreign Player Association, and you know, William put that together, and credit to him. And you had that reception in Yokohama. How was that? How was that coming back to Yokohama?
Oh, it was great. It was great. I mean, you know, it's the fact that, you know, after all these years, people are still remembering.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it was tremendous. You know, I enjoyed every moment. Just being out there, going out, you know, and meet some good people,
mm-hmm.
young kids.
Yeah.
Even kids that they don't know who I am. And, but that, you know, the fans that still remember, I still getting, you know, on Facebook and, Messenger. Oh, I remember I was 15 years old. I was 14 years old when you were playing. I was 10 years old. I said, oh my goodness, you're making me an old man.
I want to say I was 10 years old when you were playing here, but we know that ain't true.
So I mean, it just brings me good memories.
Oh,
I love the country.
Mm.
We were there for 2 weeks, my family and I, for, you know, sightseeing, you know, you know, I still have that fire in me to get back, but this time to teach.
Okay. Sometimes people come to Japan and they, as players, and they think, you know, I'm going to show them how. And so often it turns out to be the other way around. Japan shows them how. If you know what I'm talking about.
Yes.
Now, how is it? No, I mean, Japan's got so much to offer that I think people who are not familiar with Japanese baseball don't really grasp. What did you pick up, and what did Japanese be? I mean, other than playing opportunity, which is a huge thing, and I'd never belittle that, but what other things did Japanese baseball teach you or help you learn that you maybe remember you already knew?
You know, first of all, you got to be humble. Mm-hmm. That's the first thing. When I went there, I set up my mindset. I don't care. You know, the place, I don't care this, I don't care that. My goal is just to show them that I can play in this game. Now, the problem that we have, right, a lot of foreigners, when they go out there, is the fact that they want to change their system. You're not going to change it.
Mm-hmm.
You got to go by what they're you learn. You don't try to be better than them. You stay below, work your magic as a coach, as a person, humble. But you got to work hard. You got
to
work hard.
By don't try to be better than them. You mean sort of like don't try to show them up or. I mean, on the field, you got to be good. I mean, on the field, if you're not good, they're gonna send you home.
But you know, we gotta. Some place, I'm not going to mention names, but when, you know, after 5 years, you see it coming and go,
sure.
Complaining, not only in our team, but other teams.
Sure.
Complaining. Said, you know what? Why are you complaining? You're getting paid.
Yeah.
You know? And then after they get fired, they won't get back. I said, no, you know, it's too late. I, you know, when I went there, I had a purpose.
Mm-hmm.
That purpose was for me to take care of my family, to take care of myself, and to play the game.
Okay.
That was it.
Now, it was maybe less so then than it is now. I mean, now the major leagues has really evolved into, you know, swing and miss and launch angle. And Japan was a little, but then, you know, it was all the, everybody bunts. Okay, I don't, oh, no, you had no sacrifice bunts in Japan. Okay, so I just had to check that.
Yeah, no sacrifice bunts. You know, when I played, there was a lot of bunt. All that is gone. Now the... I had a chance to talk to Alex when I was there visiting.
Uh-huh.
It said they don't bunt. He doesn't bunt at all. He goes out. He He knows his players.
Mm-hmm.
He knows how to move, you know, them pretty good. But he said, Carlos, everything has evolved. It's not the same as being past. Now, you know, you got men on second. Unless it's a very close game at the end of the, you know, you can bond, you know, okay, bond, find out. But hitters, no. You go out there, you're in, you're swing. You go out. Everything has changed. The shift.
It has changed.
Everything's been moved. Yeah. I remember I used to, okay, we got the leadoff guy first.
Yep.
The next guy bunting.
Yeah.
So now I don't bunt unless it's necessary.
Okay.
Yeah, I do like to do a couple of, you know, hit and run here and there.
Mm.
But I have to, based on the team, that's how I use my guy.
Sure, has to be.
Based on the team, yeah.
Has to be.
Not just, have to be that way.
Yeah, it does. I mean, and of course, when you were here, it was so much, it was like a religion. You know, this is how baseball is, and almost anyone who says different, we're gonna make them sorry. And thank you for joining us all the way from Taiwan. So that's like real social distancing.
Yeah. Yes. Yes. Hey, listen, it's only 3 hours fly.
3 hours is better than 2 meters. Okay. Well, thanks a lot, Carlos. It was great talking to you. And John, anything you want to comment on other than my unique interview techniques?
Well, thank you very much, Carlos. I never really saw him play. I don't remember seeing him play. What was his last year in NPB?
1990, but he only played 15 games in 1990. He basically had 4 big years, 86 to 89.
Right, and 1990 was the year I came, and I really didn't see any baseball.
He played 15 games, and he wasn't very good, so that was the end.
Yeah. So here's a player who basically was going out when I was coming in, and my first full season was 1991. But I just love hearing from the older and the retired players about the brand of baseball, and that was going on at that time. And we'll have a question about that in the High Heat segment about the Mr. Baseball era, because remember when they were filming Mr. Baseball, I was living in Nagoya and had an opportunity to go and be one of the extras as people in the stadium filling up the stadium to cheer, but I had to work. And so I was an English teacher, and mostly we were working in the evenings when they were filming those things. So I didn't get an opportunity to do that, but.
Well, they're probably happy you weren't in the movie, because people would
not
remember Tom Selleck.
Although I did see Tom Selleck in Nagoya at some point, but from a distance. But anyway, I like hearing the stories about the bunting and the lack of power. And one of the first things I observed when I saw Japanese baseball for the first time, I'm sure Carlos experienced it, was, you know, the general size of the players. The physical size was not intimidating, and the outfield arms were weak, and for the most part. And, you know, I assume as Carlos played with some of these guys, he just tired of the whole brand of baseball. I guess it can wear on you if you just have a different approach, a different mindset toward baseball. But I love what he said when he talked about him adjusting. And I like that question, because you often ask guys about guys who are non-American who have already gone through the adjustment of going across a border into another country to play baseball and to attack that style of baseball, because you know it's going to be different, or you think it's different, or you can obviously see that it's different. And instead of complaining, you just figure out a way to be successful.
Yeah.
And I loved that approach from him. And, you know, I assume, again, those days, the olden days, hearing about those games, I assume he couldn't speak the language and he didn't know a lot of the players, and he had little idea what was going on when he started. And he didn't talk about exactly how he ended up in Japan.
That was kind of the story we steered away from, because it got like, let's just say the person who steered him to Japan was a guy who basically made his living. He had a whole side business. He was working in MLB front offices. and his side business was shipping players to Japan. And
that's his side.
And Carlos, and I'll say, when Carlos mentioned his name, he said, and he told me, I don't make any money off of this. And Carlos inflected it exactly like I did.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. That was my response. Yeah.
Yeah. This shady Cuban, the go-between guy, right? Who doesn't make any money by getting you to defect.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. All for the love of the game. And
yeah.
And the same guy brought over Bobby Rose and Tuffy Rhodes. So he was with the Red Sox and he was with the Angels and he was with the Brewers. And I talked to somebody years later, and I don't know him. I don't know him. I never met him. He's passed away. And some beat writer, major league beat writer, who was in town for the MLB Japan All-Star Games.
Mm-hmm.
In 2006, said, oh, he's got to be infamous as the worst MLB executive in history.
Oh, my goodness. That bad, huh?
Yeah. So, So he had a thing going, and it's a thing, and I don't know this, and I don't want to cast aspersions, but there's kind of an old thing in Japan where some players would get contracts much bigger than they were worth, much bigger than their reputation in America merited.
Okay.
And some of that money would be kicked back to various people for offering that contract. So people with the Japanese team and people who from the American team would basically fleece the Japanese companies who weren't in it ostensibly to make money.
Right. Well, I was glad to hear that Carlos actually came over here and has talked to Alex Ramirez and still keeps in touch with the team. Although when you asked him about him still following Japanese baseball, and he said, yeah, you didn't ask him how, because I would really like to know how he stays in contact. And obviously we serve as a conduit to people who have been here in the past and who play. And obviously if they listen to the podcast, then they can get Bobby Scales. I know is one of the guys who, I don't know if he listens to every episode, but he stays in contact by listening to us. And so I was curious about that. And then I kind of disagreed with him that all the bunting has disappeared from Japan, that it has changed a lot. I know they're moving away from that automatic bunt when there's a guy on first.
Well, that's the thing. Yeah. He was talking about really 80s baseball.
Yeah.
When it was huge. And not only was huge, they had a lot of very, very small stadiums at that time. Jingu was smaller. Nagoya Stadium, the Central League was Jingu.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
That was
definitely.
like 15, the outfield wall was about 10 or 12 feet closer to the field, to home plate.
Yeah, but he's saying that it's gone now, that the bunting is gone, and I think the game is evolving.
Yeah, well, I think he's going from a place where if you didn't bunt 150 times, your team didn't bunt 150 times, you were considered somehow culturally defective.
Right.
You're not, you know, when you're not satisfying the culture, I guess Bob would say, Bob Whiting would call it, you weren't, you know, praying earnestly enough at the God of the sacrifice bunt. So the bunting shrine was not tended properly, but
back-toting fool.
Yeah, it has changed quite a bit. I mean, I was curious to see if they ever asked him to bunt, because he was that kind of player who certainly could have.
Right, and I like how you looked it up. But yeah, and we're going to address the evolution of MPB later in a question that has come up in high heat. But I think so many aspects of the game have changed, and those automatic bunt situations maybe aren't so automatic anymore, but I wouldn't say it's gone. And then him saying being fundamental and the defense part that it was defense that was so important. But I also had a blast from the past because he mentioned the name Dale Swim. And Dale Spam, I used my Stratomatic team. Remember, I think I
Right.
told you about this. About 10 guys when I was in college, we got together and formed our own league, and we drafted all the best players. And Dale Spam was on my Stratomatic team. So I don't even remember. I think I used him as a backup or a pinch hitter because he used to kill, I think it was a switch hitter, and he killed lefties or righties or something. I can't remember, but his splits were really good on one side. So I'd use him to pinch hit. But yeah, I think some of the aspects of Japanese baseball have really remained remarkably untouched and uncontaminated and sacred. But we will.
Contaminated. I like that.
Yes. Because, well, we will move on with this later, but there's so many aspects. But I did enjoy the chat. And like I said, I just really like hearing from these guys who tell it like it was so that we can get more of our bearings of how what we're seeing now and what it used to be are different, because we can hear, we can talk about it on our show and we can say what we observed. But when you get a guy who actually played and was out there, I think it just gives them more of a reference point to start from to evaluate what you're seeing now.
Yeah, I was kind of freaking out as I do in sort of my freaking out way, which is, just kind of staring into the space and going, "What the is going on here?" When I saw he's 61 years old, he's about 6 months older than I am. And so he was here when I, he came here short to Japan shortly after I did. So we were really contemporaries, and I started watching. He was one of my favorite players when I started watching NPB. Really, just a solid guy, a really no nonsense player. I mean, just like his, if you, there are not a lot of YouTube video of him as a player, but if you look, he's very still in the batter's box. And just this, just a really strong, powerful swing. But he was, I remembered him as a home run hitter, oddly enough. And what surprised me was when he, as soon as he said, I did all these things and I had all these triples and doubles and 50 doubles in the minor leagues. And I'm going, holy Moses. And I looked at his numbers in Japan and I'm going, wow. And of course, if you look at his Wikipedia page in Japanese, I love this. I love this about Japan, or at least I hate it about Japan. Those two are kind of connected.
Right,
It
love-hate relationships
yeah,
make the world go around.
it has a table with his career results in MLB and NPB. Played one MLB season and played 21 games. I'll talk about that in a second. But it says, in his career in NPB, it has him leading the league in hits and doubles and triples once. Hits once, doubles once, triples once, home runs once, total bases twice, home runs twice, slugging average once, sacrifice flies twice. And then below it has a summary of his accomplishments and it has titles. And it said
Okay.
home run leader one, RBI leader two. Hits leader one, and it just forgets the walks, it forgets the slugging
We'll
average.
just set those aside for now,
Yeah, exactly. I mean, this is reminiscent of that era. I remember because Kazuhiro Kiyohara, another contemporary of his when he was a youngster, basically they said he's never led the league in every year it was, he's never led the league in anything. And then you look back and see he led the league in on base percentage about six or seven times. He led the league in runs scored a number of times. But what he meant was he never led the league in a triple crown category. Right, exactly. So
Something I will, mention later on when we get to it.
exactly. So that was the thing that got me. And I've got a trivia question for you listeners, and I'll we'll share this next week, and we'll share it on my blog maybe in a week or so. But I was just curious, how many players in NPB history have led their league at least once in their career in home runs, triples, doubles, and RBIs? And just as another clue, I could throw in slugging average too, because it's the same group of five guys into Carlos Ponce. So your mission is how many of those five can you name?
Okay, all right. And I won't try now.
No. Okay, yeah. Okay. You know, John knows everything.
Look, we talked before we started recording, but I don't know anything.
So it was fun, and I'd always, as I said, he was a player I kind of grew up. He was a player I really liked when I was kind of sinking my teeth into NPB in the late 80s.
Mm-hmm.
They were, and he said something which I do have to kind of correct, because he said that he was, you know, I commented that he was a departure from the Bay Stars when they were the Tayo Whales.
Mm-hmm.
And I've talked about this a bit, and I've written about it a lot, that the Tayo Whales, when they moved to Yokohama in 1978, they moved from a bandbox. They had been playing in Kawasaki, and they were scoring a zillion runs a year. And they moved to Yokohama, which is essentially an MLB-sized stadium with these high, towering outfield walls. And and somebody in the team decided at some point that this is like an MLB park, and it's larger than most of the NPB parks. It's bigger than Hiroshima. It's bigger than Nagoya. It was bigger than Karakuen. It was bigger than Jingu. That it should be, they should build a team like the St. Louis Cardinals of the 80s or the Philadelphia Phillies of the early 80s. You know, run, okay, slap hitting. Let's hit the ball on the AstroTurf and run like crazy. And what happened was they ended up with, they had a lot of fairly good players, but they basically decided that power hitters weren't their thing. And so,
okay. We don't need that.
Yeah, exactly.
We don't want those. No, those back.
It was exactly, they were going to run everybody to death. And manager Sadao Kondo was one of the managers, and the late Junzo Sekine was another, who developed these guys who were basically fast. They had the go-kart trio. I remember Wayne Grasek used to talk all about these guys a lot. And Yutaka Takagi, a popular commentator, was one of them. I'm not going to go into the other two guys, but they were basically base stealers. And Carlos said, "Oh, I changed the team." And he didn't really. Actually, he was a replacement for the guy who changed the team, who was Leon Lee.
Okay.
Leon Lee was the guy who was basically Carlos Ponce before Carlos Ponce was Carlos Ponce. And then Leon, we went to the Swallows, and Carlos Ponce was his replacement. And then the last thing I want to say about Carlos Ponce is he had a kind of interesting career in that he played his entire minor league career. He came from Puerto Rico, and at that time Puerto Rico was not involved in the U.S. draft.
Okay.
So he was an unsigned free agent, like every player from Puerto Rico at that time. And he played for the Milwaukee Brewers. And for some reason, he got sidetracked onto being a first baseman. This guy could run and throw and do all these things. And the Brewers had a first baseman. They had an all-star first baseman, Cecil Cooper.
Okay.
And Cecil Cooper was an outstanding player. And the irony is, although Carlos Ponce was not a grade A minor league prospect, as soon as he went to Japan, Cecil Cooper's career basically died. And the Brewers didn't have a guy who was like Carlos Ponce would have been absolutely their best answer to fill in for Cecil Cooper at first base or to play another position.
Right.
But they shipped him to Japan.
Well, that conversation that you had about the positions, right, and what he was doing reminded me of the conversation I had at the WBC with Jonathan Scope of the Dutch team, mm-hmm, that I had with him in, I guess, and yeah, I'm pretty sure it was. And I didn't know who he was, just some dude on the Dutch team bench, and we were all waiting for Eriksson Profar to come out so we could talk to him. And so we're talking to Jonathan, and he just mentioned the fact that, you know, I had never played whatever position it was, but he said, I had never played this position, but one time somebody got injured.
Mm-hmm.
And the manager came up to me and said, can you play this position? And he said, I'd never played it in my life, but I wasn't about to say that. I wanted those four ABs. So yep. I said, yeah, I can play that. And and so it turns out Scope goes out after that and makes it with the Baltimore Orioles, and he's playing Major League Baseball. And I'm like, yeah, I talked to that dude on the bench and with the Dutch team, and I had no idea he was going to be a Major League player, that he was that good. I thought he was just some dude who showed up for WBC. So, you know, getting those four at-bats or getting in the game is the thing. And that's the other thing I thought about when I was listening to the chat, was a lot of times when we see players we don't know, and we don't have anything to reference, no stats or anything to reference, sometimes we just assume that's the position that they've always played. Mm-hmm. And that they're really good at it. And when they make mistakes, we want to scream at them. But sometimes guys are out there just trying to get four at-bats.
Well, I remember I've told this story before on about March 20th, I think, 1995. I was at on a freezing cold day in Yokohama. A bunch of my baseball net friends, including former San Francisco Giants scout, later to be a San Francisco Giants scout, Jeff Kusumoto, my ex and some other people, were watching a game between the Kintetsu Buffaloes and the Yokohama Bay Stars. And the first year Buffalo's right fielder that day dropped two balls at the right field wall. And my prediction was, oh, this guy is never, you know, they're going to take this guy and ship him back to America. I mean, what did he ever do? Okay, yeah, he hit three home runs off Doc Gooden on opening day one year, but, you know, this guy's a nobody. And Tuffy Rhodes later told me, he says, yeah, I hadn't played right field in like 6 years, or maybe since he was in high school.
Right, but it was Tuffy Rhodes you were talking about.
Okay, it turns out that the guy I said wouldn't, you know, probably wouldn't make it a year, had the best career of any foreign player in Japanese baseball history.
History.
That's my prediction.
So I love it. I like that part too. All right, so let's transition, make a four-seam transition, and talk about the schedule situation. So you wrote what I would call a scathing post about Japan's handling of the coronavirus. And there were some glimmers of hope. I believe I saw NHK yesterday or last night had a report that the Rakuten Eagles were opening up their stadium and their facility for the first time in 40 days and had some players mm-hmm. come back to work out at the facility. So that was nice. And I did see another news report on TV this past week that said, okay, well, we're looking at a schedule in July. If we can't get 120 games, then that wouldn't be a season worthwhile, or I don't even know how to really to word it but the way they said it, but they couldn't do it because you need at least 120 games. I'm like, who are you? You're just news people. You're just talking heads. How can you decide that?
Hey, that's us.
Oh, wait a second. No, we're talking voices. We're disembodied.
if you are seeing us as we speak, call your doctor.
Call your doctor or get out of my computer, one or the other or both. So, you know, the issues of pushing a season into November, early December, you know, maybe not so ideal. But look, the whole world is in a non-ideal situation. So just shut up with that. You know, I don't want to hear that stuff anymore. If you want to play a season, play a season if it's possible. If you don't, just call it off now. But I think those were glimmers of hope, and I'm hoping that we can, because we were watching the KBO and the CPBL, which are playing, and you've got the KBO on ESPN broadcast. Oh, I'm wondering, did you see the game on Thursday night, I think it was, on ESPN? Probably not.
I did not watch ESPN because I do not subscribe to ESPN.
Oh, it's on the internet. I was watching it.
I had the Korean broadcast on a different stream.
Okay, good. So Adam Jones of Oryx was interviewed during the ESPN broadcast, and I think they kept him on for a full inning. So it was really nice to have a piece of MPB appearing in this KBO situation and on air. And you know, he talked, Adam Jones talked about his situation, what's going on in Japan. And I was just so jealous because I'm looking at these KBO players and they know the games are on ESPN. Mm-hmm. So the upper or the elite guys in that league are certainly looking at this as a chance to audition for sure.
Sure.
And then I just felt so badly for, because, you know, we've heard or I've seen or I've read about people saying that the level of baseball is this, that, and the other. And I'm like, you guys, this is the only sport going on, man. Don't criticize. Just watch and enjoy. Okay, maybe it's a little bit lower level, but so is college baseball. Just enjoy it. And there's just so much going on. But the fact that there's some live baseball, some guys where we can watch games and we don't know what the score is. We don't know who the players are. We don't know who to look for. Sometimes we see guys like in this particular game that Adam Jones, in which he appeared as an interviewee, we got to see David Buchanan, who the former Swallows right-hander was the starter for, I can't remember what team it was because I really wasn't paying attention much to the game, but he was the starter. So, I mean, you know, we've got these games, man, let's just sit back and enjoy them. And, you know, but I kept thinking, man, NPB, you're behind the whole thing. And so you wrote a post about how Japan really has really not handled this coronavirus situation very well. But in terms of the schedule, what was your thinking about that or anything that I said there?
My point was that the U.S. and Japan have had similar responses, which has been to shut things down in sort of hopes that it kind of hiding, trying to hide from the coronavirus and hope it goes away.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're going to, you know, it's like me when I was a little boy watching Night of the Living Dead on a summer night with all the windows open. And I would like hide behind the door and like see if the room was full of zombies. And I would like close my eyes and hope that when I opened them again, there would be no zombies. And that's
there probably wouldn't be because you'd be dead.
Well, but that was the thing, you know, it was one of those movies that gave me that scared the living bejesus out of me when I was a youngster. And that's how NPB and the US and Japan have handled this in a sense that they haven't done the things, the testing and the isolating and the identifying who's got it and who doesn't have it that allows them to move forward and isolate pockets of the disease. They just shut things down. So
yeah, and disinfecting, I remember that was the thing that still stands out to me is seeing in South Korea, just crews out there disinfecting the heavy traffic areas of the city, the subway systems and stuff like that. And we just haven't seen that in Japan
at all.
No, we have
not. We haven't seen it in America either. And here's the thing. Okay, well, it's fine. And so basically what they did was lower the infection rates. But they haven't really done anything about the fact that this virus is still all over the place. Okay, so if they open up, then they're likely, again, nobody knows, but they're likely, and the argument for the people who want to open up is that, well, nobody knows, so let's do it. This was our colleague's argument for saying there were 55,000 people watching the Yankees and the Tampa Bay Rays play baseball. And I said, you know, there aren't 55,000. He says, well, I don't know there aren't. So I said, like, oh, geez, dude, come on. You know there aren't. Well, I'm going to write it because it sounds better. Okay, so that's the process that Japan and the U.S. are both taking. So my guess is that because Japan, however, is being responsible about things in general, there's no great let's push to make the economy better. I mean, people do want to, of course, make the economy better and get back to work, but there's a lot more pressure to do it safely in Japan. That while MLB is talking, okay, let's start spring training on June 10th. They're throwing these numbers out to be politically correct, you know, with the people wearing red hat crowd.
Right, right.
But we don't have that in Japan, unless you're talking about the Hiroshima card. And so the point being that my guess is Japan won't have a season at all because Japan hasn't done the things like Taiwan and Korea did to make their country safe. They just shut down to slow down the numbers. So basically, Japan, my guess is Japan will not be safe enough to play baseball this year. And I guess MLB will also not be safe enough, but there may be enough pressure on MLB that they're going to do it anyway.
Yeah, that's what I've been seeing. But to stay away from the political stuff, we every day at about 4:30 in the afternoon, we get an announcement on our PA at the office, and it tells us the number of confirmed corona cases within Tokyo. Mm-hmm. And as the numbers go down, and they've been going down this past week, everyone seems to be getting more excited. And I'm like, well, if testing has gone up and the numbers are going down, that's good. But again, we don't have any context to these numbers. They're not telling us the number of people tested. We only get the number of confirmed cases. So
yes. And if you try to, the thing is that if you try to get tested and I understand there are in America, it depends on where you live because it's all local. But in Japan, if you try to get tested, basically they tell you, no, you're not sick enough.
Right.
They also tell you things. There was a good story by Gigi Press, which said that researchers in Japan have been trying to test the deceased people for the virus to see if they had contracted the COVID-19 before they died. And the government said, well, we're not going to release that because essentially they don't want the numbers to go up.
Right, yeah.
That's the thing. And let's not make the numbers go up. And that's been the thing all along in Japan and the United States. And I think there are no honest governments. Like I said, if you find an honest government, stuff it and, put it on display because it belongs in the Smithsonian Institute as an example. Politicians are not honest. It's not in their best interest to be honest. It's in the best interest to know the truth, but. Yeah.
Right. I keep hoping beyond hope and that we'll have a season, that we'll have some games, that I didn't get my MPB pass for no reason. But, we've been able to continue doing shows, but it's going to slow down here if we don't get out to a ballpark and get some interviews with some actual players. So,
interestingly enough, in Japan, they haven't talked about, they have talked a little bit about the draft. But they haven't gone like the U.S. has and said, well, this is a big opportunity for I don't want to go into the U.S. very much. It's just a depressing it's a rabbit hole that's really sad and depressing. But the point is they haven't gone into like service time. There hasn't been any discussion about. How is this going to affect service time? In America, they're giving everybody a year's service time, regardless of, if you're on an MLB, I think if you were on a 25 man roster last year, you're getting a full year of service time. And in Japan, they haven't talked about that. I wonder, I kind of have an impression of how the SoftBank Hawks might vote on that.
Boom! Based on what they did to Yuki Yanagita last year, right?
Are you kidding?
Well, maybe we can discuss this next episode as well. But the impact on the high school kids and the college kids and the industrial league kids who are not getting an opportunity to play this season, how is that going to impact the draft?
So, well, that's, the big thing, how it's going to impact the draft. And I think this is the only logic for reducing the draft is the fact that all the guys you really wanted to see a decision on, you can't see them because they're not playing. All the scouts are sitting at home looking at all the stuff that's now 6 months, 9 months old.
Correct. Okay. Well, yeah, let's make a two-seam transition and talk about some good news. Former longtime PL skipper Masataka Nashida is not out of the hospital, but he has apparently gotten out of the woods after testing negative for COVID-19 this past week. So I suspect he'll be released from the hospital this week or next or something, but they were keeping him in the hospital just to monitor him. And Again, we've not seen a lot of news about other players and other MPB related folks coming down or being infected with coronavirus, but that's good news.
It
It's
is
always
good
good.
news. And yeah, love Mr. Nishida, and one that was a big when I posted that on Facebook that he was out, they got a huge response. People, he's a well-loved figure, so that was good news.
Okay.
Okay, we also had an obituary this past week. Matt Keogh, former Oakland A's and Hanshin Tigers pitcher. Now, his career was basically downhill when he got to the Hanshin Tigers after Billy Martin, his manager in Oakland, blew out. He had kind of a human sacrifice experiment. If all my pitchers throw complete games in a high offensive era, what'll happen to them? And most of them burned their arms out. Steve McCaddy and Mike Norris and Matt Keogh, and I'm leaving somebody out for sure. There were five of them. But he came to the Tigers after his arm was pretty much used up, but he still managed to be a game over 500 in his career during his time with the Tigers, a team that was now hold on a second, let me find the actual number here. Who when he was playing when Matt Keogh was pitching for the Tigers from 87 to 90, the Tigers had a 387 winning percentage. Over 4 seasons, they won
I was
a. Yeah, so of the games he didn't win, they were like 144 and 270 losses.
Ouch.
Yeah, that was and it was a tough place. I mean, the park they'd brought, it was still a fairly good pitcher's park, but the team had a 4.23 ERA during that stretch. It was a tough time to be playing. He was a contemporary of Carlos Ponce, by the way. In fact, they're his 4 seasons, Matt Keogh's 4 seasons in Japan overlapped with Carlos's with 3 of Carlos's best 4.
Okay. All right, so yeah, all the best to his family and
Oh,
condolences.
and the other one, which was the other trivia, which I'm sure everybody will know, is that he, or many people will know, is that he was one of 3 father and son combinations who played in Japan. And I wouldn't have remembered it except Wayne Grasek used to talk about it so much. That Matt Keogh's father, when Matt was 13, his father played a season for the Nankai Hawks. His father was a utility outfielder, a journeyman utility outfielder in the major leagues. Marty Keogh.
Marty Keogh. Okay. All right. Thank you very much for that. Let's go to fielding questions. All right, so this one comes from Roger in Tokyo via email, and he says, "Japan Baseball Weekly, let me add my voice to the chorus of please keep doing the podcast during the coronavirus break. We need it and appreciate it. Please don't stop." He said, "Here's a good, there are no games right now topic to chew on. Any of us who follow MPB knows that US-based baseball fans have lots of misconceptions about it. I think that much of the prevailing perception of Japanese baseball is fossilized in the bubble era horror stories from You Gotta Have Wah and that Tom Selleck movie, Mr. Baseball. I don't think it's a stretch to say that even though aspects of it still might drive some of us crazy, MPB teams, MPB media coverage, and the sport itself are far more sophisticated today. I'd love to hear your impressions about what has changed the most in the years since you guys started covering MPB in the 80s/90s. The teams and their attitudes about players, contracts, money, foreign players, the media, the fan stadium experience, the game on the field, everything. Maybe I'm way off, perhaps it's not that different, but that's my way of asking John and Jim. Thanks for the great hour every week. Please stay safe and healthy, Roger." So that's a lot. That's if he says
Yeah, don't ask
everything.
much. Yeah, don't. Everything's the same.
Only the world, only the world. So I started covering MPB in 1995, and I couldn't speak Japanese well enough to do interviews with the players or the coaches. And I didn't really need to do it because my paper at the time that I started publishing in Nagoya was biweekly, meaning twice a month, biweekly, not once every other month. So I could always find something to write about without really doing interviews or getting comments. But I would try to get some comments from the foreign players, whom I knew. And so I went to Nagoya Stadium at first, and it was really a dilapidated facility in which there were like no extra press box seats to accommodate somebody whose publication wasn't accredited and was fledgling at best to describe what my little paper was. So the first time I went to cover game, they allowed me into the stadium before the game, and I was able to go down and talk to a couple of the foreign players, but I couldn't sit in the press box. They told me I was free to find an open seat in the stands. So that's how that went. And that was, 1995. And eventually we got, they built Nagoya Dome, which the team allowed me to go in as they were maybe about to put the seats in. So I got to see Nagoya Dome mid-construction. The roof was on. They were putting in some of the tiles and all that stuff. So I consider that my dome because I got to cover it at that time. And then I saw them putting in the turf and all that stuff. But so in terms of how you can cover the teams, from my point of view, 1995 and covering now, it really hasn't changed all that much. Your access with the players was limited then, and it's limited the same now. The players are generally open and friendly. And now that I started doing a lot of interviews when I took this job in 2000. Well, I accepted the job in 2004. My first day was January 1st, 2005. And I started doing interviews a lot. I think I was really prolific with a lot of the Japanese players. And that's when I started to meet more of the players on teams that, it wasn't the Chunichi Dragons, and started to talk with some of those guys. The PR guys tend to be pretty much friendly, but the Tigers PR historically for me, and recently the DNA PR guys are maybe less than helpful, be one way to describe it. But geez, there's so much in there. I don't know where do you want to start in talking attacking this.
There are too many things to talk about in general. I would mention a few from covering it. I've been watching it. I've been researching it since the mid-80s and actually writing about it since my first guide to Japanese baseball was published in 1994. So I've been writing about it since that, the year before, 1993. The biggest things that are different, you will notice, is the crowds are better.
Mm-hmm.
The crowds are more homogeneous. They all have their sort of style of cheering has kind of evolved into, and I don't say they're all the same, but they all have the same sort of modes of cheering. In other words,
right, they're unique to each team.
Yes, but they have, every team's got this kind of, they've got a chance thing, it's like they've got a language. It's like they're all using the same computer language to do different programs.
Mm-hmm.
So before it used to be much more varied. Now, sort of like when one team does something, the other team's fans will copy it, and so we see this. There's an evolutionary process there. You didn't used to be able to keep foul balls,
right? Or home runs, for that matter, right?
No, home runs, I believe you could always keep.
Always, okay.
I believe so. My first pro game in Japan was a Western League game between the Hanshin Tigers Western League farm team and the Chunichi Dragons at Toyama Municipal Stadium. And when a ball bounced to me in the stands, although I was watching games on TV, I wasn't familiar with the concept that you had to give the ball back, and I couldn't understand why all the little kids were trying to steal it from me because they wanted to be the one to give it back to the usher.
Get away from me, kid. You bother me.
With the balls that were hit, the foul balls that were hit out of the little tiny Toyama Stadium. But that's one thing that changed in terms of the access. Yeah, that's about right. I think the access is going backwards a little bit. The teams are trying to make the PR guys a little bit more like gatekeepers. But
and I think part of that might be because of social media in recent years.
I think so.
That YouTube channels, and so they can do their own thing, so they don't need the conduit of the media sometimes. And so sometimes that has been limited. I would say maybe more so in the past 2-3 years, maybe even this year than in the past.
I think that's accurate. I think they're much more active on social media and they want to control the flow. They used to be able to control it by saying who's going to be in the press box. And Bob Whiting famously was banned from using a press credential to attend games at Tokyo Dome after getting the fire department that covers Tokyo Dome to actually say that 55,000, 56,000 people at the time were not allowed in there for a baseball game. And the Yomiuri Giants accused him of stealing corporate secrets.
Great.
So that changed. The treatment of the umpires has vastly improved. You don't see that when I arrived, it was very common for games to be interrupted by coaches and players shoving and bumping umpires. You don't see a lot of 160, 150 plus complete games. 150-plus-pitch complete games like you used to. They used to be probably every team would have a half dozen of them a year. And now I think you probably see, if it's not in Hideaki Wakui, I would guess probably nobody has done it in Japan in the last 6 years.
Right. What about from the media side?
On the media side, not otherwise. I guess the biggest difference was the internet. The development of the internet meant that when you were watching the game from the press box and guys had to leave their seat to go to the rest, reporters had to go to the restroom, they had to sit there and go to their colleagues and say, what happened while I was gone? Now they just flip open their notebooks and check on the web. That is
right.
That's a big difference. The last thing is when I was looking at Carlos Ponce's video before I interviewed him, I noticed that the production of the post game interview.
The TV production.
Oh my gosh! I'm looking at the production of the hero interview of Carlos Ponce at Yokohama Stadium, and it's one guy in a sweatsuit, his interpreter, and one guy in a sports shirt, but with no background, no cheerleaders. No, I mean, it was like, although to be honest, it was, it was really small. It wasn't a big production. You know, you didn't see the fans on the field doing high fives, any of that. You didn't see the players throwing players. And now they get a mascot when they hit a home run to throw into the stands. They didn't used to get one to throw into the stands, but they started doing it.
The little stuffed animal.
Right. So now they give them two, one to keep and one to throw into the stands.
For me, the media side, it just seems like, first of all, when I started in 95, I think I saw one or two women in the press box. And now the number of women has multiplied dramatically.
Yeah, probably. Yeah, indeed. When I started working for the Yomiuri in 1998, probably there were a few women who were regular baseball beat writers. There were probably a dozen in Japan. Okay. Hmm. And now it's probably 30%.
Yeah, the number has dramatically increased. And I still think the numbers that the media here in Japan looked at 50, 60 years ago are still the numbers that they look at now, you know, ERA for pitchers, home runs, and RBIs for hitters. And I sometimes fall into that category because those aspects present obvious game-deciding production, but we still don't hear a lot about WAR. We don't hear OPS so much, although sometimes on Wikipedia you see an OPS category for some of the batters, and you don't hear about contact rate and There are a lot of things that are just not out there right now and not important. And I understand it, but when we see the MVP voting that has not progressed, we've talked about that for years on this show. I think all 10 years that we've been doing it. So that hasn't grown.
Interesting. Yeah, that's largely true. The media is still the story of the game in the capsule is still who drove in the winning run. The quotes you get from the team during the game are still the same. The guy who grounded out to second base and the runner came home from third on a bad throw. It says the guy who hit the ball said, Joe Blow was pitching such a great game. I just really wanted to get that run in. I was going to do anything I could to get the run in. And of course, I love that because it implies that he was and his teammates weren't.
Or, he wanted to try particularly harder on this at bat,
exactly,
as opposed to some of the other at bats. But
kind of, it's in the first inning, they say, they say, well, I wanted to get a run first on the board. And so, it's just junk, it's just junk food for the media. It doesn't mean anything. And so, and somebody, I'll go back to this. Somebody asked me, why does Ichiro Suzuki have a difficult relationship with the media? And I think part of it is that a small part of it is that players in Japan who are the heroes, quote unquote heroes, are required to produce quotes for the media. Even when what they say is very ordinary and not worthy of quoting, and they have to talk about, they have to put things out of proportion. And they essentially have to tell a lie so that the reporters will have something to work with. And he's very sensitive towards that. I'm not being evaluated on what I did in the game. I'm being evaluated on how good I am telling lies to the media.
Well, yeah, but I think part of that is just, I think, like baseball fans and baseball media here, they treat the sport like sort of like motor racing, in that, when you're watching motor racing, sometimes you're not really watching the race. You're waiting for the crash. And that's what a lot of people tend to do here. They wait for the big crash, the big home run, the big strikeout, the big hit. And if you're not involved in that, then it's basically, that's kind of boring. And so that's why I said those aforementioned stats, especially the long balls, are so easy to see and so easy to process that's what ends up being touted as the best thing that happened that day. But that's not always the case. Sometimes it is that third inning run scoring ground ball that got the run home and got that extra run that ended up being the winning run in the end. But
and it's very rarely the guy, and I mean, the typical hero is, the guy who walked, stole second, went to third on a wild pitch and scored on a close play that he shouldn't even have. He shouldn't have been safe on. His speed and quickness and alertness scored the run. And the hero is the guy who hit the ground ball at second.
Right, right.
And because that's what they do. It's the guy who has the RBI counts.
Exactly. And I wanted to give a shout out to Larry Rocha, going back to what you were talking about, the fans, because Larry Rocha came here with Bobby Valentine I forgot what the title of his position was with the Marines, but he came.
It was the Swiss Army PR guy, was he not?
Yeah. And where, I think he changed
12 arms,
it was Valentine's second stint with the team, right?
2004. Yeah.
That's when I started to hear the term fan service, which resulted here in Japan. But basically, that was the way they called enhancing the fan experience and thinking about the fan experience. And because you were talking about the fans and how their cheering has changed and all that, and I just thought about how the Marines really wanted the players, the fans, everybody who came to the park that day, regardless of what the scoreboard outcome was. Mm-hmm. To have fun with the food, the atmosphere, and the product, the entire product. Yeah, and he was part of that movement in that during that time in the 2000 in the aughts, and you started hearing the fan service, and you started to see teams change and do more to enhance the experience and make it more fun for everybody, especially it seems like the children, but you know everybody, because there are some diehard fans in Japan and they're very serious about it. But yeah, I think we could talk about these topics forever. It's such a vast pool of topics that Roger gave us to talk about. Maybe we can continue it next week or something. Hone in on one particular thing, but
Yeah, I mean, the game has changed quite a bit, and I spend a lot of time reading about Japanese baseball in the 70s, and I'm struck by how radically different how radically different the fan environment was. I always like to ask the players what it was like, and but you read stories from the early 70s about the commissioner having to tell players not to beat each other up on the field, and not to go after fans, and not to go after umpires, and fans not to throw bottles at players on the field.
Hashtag high heat.
Gosh.
So,
Yes,
yeah,
behave.
I know, but you know, they did have riots. They had pitch invasions in Japanese baseball in the 70s. It was not a run, you know, a rare event, which is why actually I think when you know why they have the netting around the infield in all the NPB parks. I think originally that was to keep the fans in the stand.
Not only to protect
Yeah,
the
it was to protect the players, not the fans.
fans. Okay. All right. Well, perhaps we'll if we think about some more topics or some more aspects that we can mention next week, we'll continue this. But let's move on to Pete's question. He hit us up on Facebook about 2 weeks ago, and he said, "Hey, I just caught up with the Top 10 Catcher Show. My podcasts are piling up with no commuting. I love the lists and especially the misunderstanding and how you were ranking. If you guys are looking for other stuff to talk about, I'd love to see top 10s in other infield positions." And then he talked about Yutaro Umeno drove me nuts at first, wiggling around back there, stabbing at pitches. He's getting better by the second. I really like Seishiro Sakamoto too. Randy Messenger really likes him, I want to point out. And then Tatsuhiro Tamura is my favorite catcher. He says my son played with him in junior high school.
Ah.
So, thank you, Pete. All the infield positions, I don't know if we can do that. I don't know if we can find a top 10. So,
I thought you were
having
going to
a.
ask for the top 10 misunderstandings between us. We don't have we have we have we have candidates from every show we recorded in the last 10 years.
We have a top 100, yeah.
Pretty much. Casey Kasem, look out.
So, having an on-mic meeting here, remember you said you couldn't get to 10 catchers, and I'm not sure we could get to 10 at each infield position, but how about
It would be
can we break it
fantastic.
up, like corner infielders and then middle infielders? Can we do that, or do you want to go and why leave out the outfielders?
I think go with 10, and if you've got 10, you got 10, and if you don't have 10, you know, I mean, I just see that a lot of positions are, it's hard for me to discern the difference between who's the often who's the sixth best and who's the 13th best.
I'm with you.
The talent progresses the farther down. I mean, you know,
Well,
somebody.
sometimes we don't have, you know, there's teams that platoon a lot, or if
True.
guys got injured,
That's
or,
true.
you know,
Especially
this
with
guy might be
catcher.
the.
In fact, that was the start of the question. Why are the, you know, why do the Dragons need 17 catchers? Okay, I
If you have 17 catches, you don't have one.
pretty much. I mean, why haven't they been able to stick with a regular catcher was the question, and that was another huge rabbit hole. So
Right. So what do you want to do for next week? What are we going to do here?
we could do, I mean, top 10 fielding first baseman seems like a kind of a sad topic.
Hashtag high heat.
All
I
right.
already know who's 24th on John's list.
24th.
How about best piano playing first baseman?
How about we end this? How about thank you for the questions, Pete and Roger, and
okay.
Anybody else?
Okay, Yamakawa-san, that was a shout out for you. So in case.
Okay. All right. Anyone else who has a question, please send to yakyujohn@gmail.com. Hit us up on Twitter @JBW Podcast or leave us a note on the Facebook page. So we've got this question in the bag. We'll work on that, but please send something to us, including MP3s, and make sure you hashtag the Twitter shout outs with High Heat. We will talk to you next week. Enjoy your lockdown.
See you safe at home.